singing? Whose voice? Wondered Karras. And then fragments entered his mind. Denning's. The window. Drained, he saw Sharon come back into the room and take the towel from Merrin's hands. I'll finish that, Father, she told him. I'm okay now. I'd like to change her and get her cleaned up before I give her the compassine, okay? Could you both wait outside for a while? The priests left the room, stepping into the warmth and the dimness of the hall, where they both leaned wearily against the wall, their heads down, their arms folded, as they listened to the eerie, muffled singing from within. It was Karras who at last broke the silence. You said earlier, Father, there was only one entity we're dealing with?
Yes.
The hushed tones, the lowered heads were confessional. All the others are but forms of attack, continued Merrin.
There is one. Only one. It is a demon.
There was a silence. Then Merrin stated simply, I know you doubt this, Damien, but this demon I have met once before, and he is powerful, Damien, powerful. A silence. Then Karras spoke again. Father, we say the demon cannot touch the victim's will.
Yes, that is so. There is no sin.
Then what would be the purpose of possession? What's the point?
Ah, who can know, answered Merrin. Who can really hope to know?
And yet, I think the demon's target is not the possessed.
It is us, the observers, every person in this house.
And I think the point is to make us despair, to reject our own humanity, Damien, to see ourselves as ultimately bestial, vile and putrescent, without dignity, ugly, unworthy. And there lies the heart of it, perhaps. Yes, in unworthiness. For I think belief in God is not a matter of reason at all. I think it finally is a matter of love, of accepting the possibility that God could ever love us.
Merrin paused, then continued more slowly and with an air of introspection.
Again, who really knows? But it is clear, at least to me, that the demon knows where to strike.
Oh, yes. Yes, he knows.
Long ago, I despaired of ever loving my neighbor. Certain people, they repelled me. And so how could I love them, I thought.
It tormented me, Damien. It led me to despair of myself, and from that, very soon, to despair of my God.
My faith was shattered.
Surprised, Karras turned and looked at Merrin directly with interest.
And what happened? He asked.
Ah, well, I at last realized that God would never ask of me that which I know to be psychologically impossible.
That the love which he asked was in my will,
and not meant to be felt as emotion.
No, no, not at all.
He was asking that I act with love, that I do unto others, and that I should do it unto those who repelled me, I believe, was a greater act of love than any other.
Merrin lowered his head and spoke even more softly.
I know that all of this must seem very obvious to you, Damien, I know.
But at the time, I could not see it.
Strange blindness.
How many husbands and wives, Merrin uttered sadly, must believe they have fallen out of love because their hearts no longer race at the sight of their beloveds.
Ah, dear God.
He shook his head,
And then he nodded. There it lies, I think, Damien. Possession. Not in wars, as some tend to believe. No, not so much. And very rarely in extraordinary interventions such as here. This girl, this poor child. No, I tend to see possession most often in the little things, Damien. In the senseless, petty spites and misunderstandings. The cruel and cutting word that leaps unbidden to the tongue between friends, between lovers, between husbands and wives. Enough of these, and we have no need of Satan to manage our wars. These we manage for ourselves. For ourselves. The lilting singing in the bedroom could still be heard, drawing Marin to look up at the door with a distant stare. And yet even from this, from evil, there will finally come good in some way that we may never understand or even see. Marin paused. Perhaps evil is the crucible of goodness, he brooded. And perhaps even Satan, in spite of himself, somehow serves to work out the will of God. Marin said no more, and for a time they stood in silence while Karras reflected, until another objection came to his mind. Once the demon's driven out, he asked, what's to keep it from coming back in? I don't know, Marin answered. Yet it never seems to happen. No, never. Marin put a hand to his face, pinching tightly at the corners of his eyes. Damien, what a wonderful name, he murmured. Karras heard exhaustion in his voice. And something else, some anxiety, something like repression of pain. Abruptly, Marin pushed himself away from the wall, and with his face still hidden in his hand, he excused himself and hurried down the hall to a bathroom. What was wrong, wondered Karras. He felt a sudden envy and admiration for the exorcist's strong and simple faith. Then he turned toward the door. The singing, it had stopped. Had the night at last ended? Some minutes later, Sharon came out of the bedroom with a foul-smelling bundle of bedding and clothing. She's sleeping now, she said. And then she looked away quickly and moved off down the hall. Karras took a deep breath and re-entered the bedroom, felt the cold, smelled the stench. He walked slowly to the bedside. Regan, asleep, at last. And at last, Karras thought, he could rest. He reached down, gripped Regan's thin wrist, and then lifting his other arm, he stared at the sweep-second hand of his watch. Why you do this to me, Dimmy? The Jesuit's heart froze over. Dimmy, why you do this? Karras did not move, did not breathe, did not dare to glance over to the sorrowful voice to see whether those eyes were really there, eyes accusing, eyes lonely, his mother's. His mother's?
You leave me to be priest, Demi. Send me institution.
Don't look.
Now you chase me away.
It's not her.
Why you do this?
His head throbbing, his heart in his throat. Karras shut his eyes tightly as the voice grew imploring, grew frightened and tearful.
You're always good boy, Demi. Please, I am afraid. Please do not chase me outside, Demi, please.
You're not my mother.
Outside, nothing. Only dark, Demi, lonely.
You're not my mother, Karras vehemently whispered.
Demi, please.
You're not my mother.
Demi, please.
You're not my mother! Oh, for heaven's sake, Karras.
The Dennings personality had appeared. Look, it simply isn't fair to drive us out of here, it wheedled. Look now, speaking for myself, it's only justice I should be here. I admit it. But the bitch destroyed my body, and I think it's only right that I ought to be allowed to stay in hers, don't you think? Oh, for Christ's sake, look at me, Karis, now would you? Come along. I mean, it isn't very often I get to speak my piece. Just turn around now. I won't bite you or spit vomit or anything else of that boorish sort. This is me now. Karis opened his eyes and saw the Dennings personality. Oh, there, that's better, it continued. Look, she killed me. Not our innkeeper, Karis. She! Oh, yes, indeed. It was nodding affirmation. She! I was minding my business at the bar, you see, when I thought I heard her moaning from upstairs in her bedroom. Well, now, I had to see what ailed her, after all. So up I went, and don't you know she bloody took me by the throat, the little cunt? The voice was whiny now, pathetic. Christ, I've never in my life seen such strength. Began screaming that I was diddling her mother or some such nonsense, and that I caused the divorce. Well, it wasn't clear. But I tell you, love, she pushed me out the bloody fucking window. The voice cracking and high-pitched. She fucking killed me, all right. Now you think it's bloody fair to throw me out of her? I mean, really, Karis, do you? Karis swallowed, then spoke hoarsely. Well, if you're really Burke Dennings... I keep telling you, I am. Are you cutting deaf? Well, if you are, then tell me, how did your head get turned around? Bloody Jesuit. What was that? It shifted its gaze around evasively. Oh, well, the head thing. Yes, freaky thing, that. Yes, very, very freaky. I give you that. How did it happen? It turned away. Oh, well, frankly, who gives a good damn front or back? It's all sixes and sevens, you know, twiddles and twaddles. Looking down, Karis picked up Reagan's wrist again and glanced at his watch as he counted her pulse rate.
Dimmy, please, please no make me be all alone.
His mother.
If instead of be priest you was doctor. I live in a nice house, Dimmy, not with the cockroach, not all by myself in the lousy apartment.
His eyes on his watch, Karis strained to block it all out, as once again he heard the sound of weeping.
Dimmy, please.
You're not my mother. Oh, won't you face the truth? It was the demon, seething. You believe what Merrin tells you, you fool? You believe him to be holy and good? Well, he is not. He is proud and unworthy. I'll prove it to you, Karis. I will prove it by killing the piglet. She will die, and neither you nor Merrin's god will save her. She will die from Merrin's pride and your incompetence. Bungler, you should not have given her the Librium. Stunned, Karis looked up into eyes that were shining with triumph and with piercing spite, then looked down at his wristwatch again. Noticing her pulse, are we, Karis? Are we? Karis frowned worriedly. The pulse beat was rapid and feeble, croaked the demon. Ah, yes, for the moment, yes, just a bit feeble, or just a trifle. Karis let go of Reagan's wrist, fetched his medical bag hurriedly to the bedside, plucked out a stethoscope and pressed the resonator to Reagan's chest as the demon rasped. Listen, Karis, listen, listen well. Karis listened and grew even more concerned. Reagan's heart tone sounded distant and inefficient. I will not let her sleep. Chill. Karis flicked his glance up to the demon. Yes, Karis, she will not sleep. Do you hear? I will not let the piglet sleep. As the demon put its head back in gloating laughter, Karis stared numbly.
He did not hear Merrin come back into the room until the exorcist was standing beside him and intently and worriedly studying Reagan's face. "What is it, Damien?" Merrin asked.
"It's the demon. It said it wouldn't let her sleep."
Karras turned a vanquished stare up to Merrin.
"Her heart's begun to work inefficiently, Father. If she doesn't get rest pretty soon, she'll die of cardiac exhaustion."
Merrin frowned, his expression grave. "Can't you give her something? Drugs? Some medicine to make her sleep?"
"No, that's dangerous. She might go into coma."
Karras turned his gaze to Reagan. She was clucking like a hen in a barnyard.
"If her blood pressure drops any more..."
The priest's voice trailed off. "What can be done?" Merrin asked.
"Nothing. Nothing," Karras answered.
His anxious gaze returned to Merrin.
"But I don't know," he said. I can't be sure. I mean, maybe there's been some recent new advances. I'm going to call in a cardiac specialist."
Merrin nodded and said, Yes, Damien. That would be good." He watched as Karras closed the bedroom door behind him and then added very softly,
"And I will pray."
Karras found Chris keeping vigil in the kitchen, and from the room off the pantry he heard Willie sobbing, heard Carl's consoling voice as he explained the urgent need for consultation, while carefully not divulging the full extent of Reagan's danger. Chris gave him permission, and Karras telephoned a friend, a noted specialist at the Georgetown University Medical School, awakening him from sleep and then briefing him tersely.
"Be right there," said the specialist. In less than half an hour, he arrived at the house, where once in Reagan's bedroom, he reacted to the cold and the stench, and Reagan's condition with bewilderment, with horror and compassion.
When he'd entered the room, Reagan was quietly croaking gibberish, and while he examined her, she alternately sang and made animal noises. Then Dennings appeared.
"Oh, it's terrible," it whined at the specialist. "Just awful. Oh, I do hope there's something you can do. Is there something? We'll have no place to go, you see, otherwise, and all because... Oh, damn the stubborn devil."
As the specialist stared with wide eyes while taking Reagan's blood pressure, Dennings looked to Karras and complained.
"What the hell are you doing? Can't you see the little bitch should be in a hospital? She belongs in a madhouse, Karras. Now you know that. For heaven's sakes, why can't we stop all this cunting mumbo jumbo? If she dies, you know, the fault will be yours. Oh, yes, all yours. I mean, just because God's self-anointed second son is being stubborn doesn't mean that you have to behave like a snot. You're a doctor. You should know better, Karras. Now come along, dear heart. Have compassion. There's just a terrible shortage of housing these days."
And now back came the demon, howling like a wolf. Expressionless, the specialist undid the blood pressure wrappings, and still a little wide-eyed and bewildered, he nodded at Karras. He was finished. They went out into the hall, where the specialist looked back at the bedroom door before turning back to Karras and asking, "What in the hell is going on in there, Father?" The Jesuit averted his glance.
"I can't say."
"You can't, or you won't." Karras turned his gaze back to him.
"Maybe both," he said.
"So what's the story with her heart?" The specialist's manner was somber. "She has got to stop that activity. She has got to sleep. To sleep before her blood pressure drops. Is there anything I can do, Mike?"
"Pray."
As the specialist walked away, Karras watched him, his every artery and nerve begging rest, begging hope, begging miracles, even though he felt certain that there would be none. And then, shutting his eyes, he winced as he remembered.
You should not have given her the Librium.
He put a fist to his mouth as his throat made a soft, convulsive sound of regret and stinging self-recrimination. He took a deep breath, then another, and then opening his eyes and moving forward, he pushed open the door to Reagan's bedroom with a hand less heavy than his soul. Marin stood by the bedside, watching while Reagan neighed shrilly like a horse. He heard Karras enter and turn to look at him inquiringly, and Karras somberly shook his head. Marin nodded. There was sadness in his face, then acceptance. And as he turned back to Reagan, there was grim resolve. Marin knelt by the bed. "Our Father," he began. Reagan splattered him with dark, stinking bile, and then croaked,
"You will lose. She will die. She will die."
Karras picked up his copy of the Roman ritual, opened it, looked up and stared at Reagan. "Save your servant," prayed Marin, "in the face of the enemy."
"Go to sleep, Reagan. Sleep," shouted Karras's will.
But Reagan did not sleep. Not by dawn, not by noon, not by nightfall, and not even Sunday when her pulse rate was 140 and even threadier, while the fits continued unremittingly, and while Karras and Marin kept repeating the ritual, never sleeping, Karras feverishly groping for remedies, a restraining sheet to hold Reagan's movements to a minimum, keeping everyone out of the bedroom for a time to see if lack of provocation might terminate the fits. Neither method was successful. And Reagan's shouting was as draining as her movements, yet the blood pressure held. "But how much longer?" Karras agonized. "Oh, God, don't let her die." The aching prayer of his mind was repeated so often, it was almost a litany. "Don't let her die. Let her sleep. Let her sleep." At approximately 7 p.m. that Sunday, Karras sat mutely next to Marin in the bedroom, exhausted and racked by the demon's scathing attacks. His lack of faith, his medical incompetence, his flight from his mother in search of status. And Reagan, his fault.
"You should not have given her the Librium."
The priests had just finished a cycle of the ritual and were resting, listening to Reagan singing Panis Angelicus in that same sweet choir boy's voice. They rarely left the room. Karras wants to change clothes and to shower. But in the cold, it was easier to stay wakeful, even in the stench that since early morning had altered in character to the gorge-raising odor of decayed, rotted flesh. Staring feverishly at Reagan with reddened eyes, Karras thought he heard a sound, something creaking. Then again, each time Karras blinked. And then he realized it was coming from his own crusted eyelids. He turned his head to look at Marin. Through the hours, the elderly exorcist had said very little. Now and then a homely story of his boyhood, reminiscences, little things, a story about a duck he once owned named Clancy. Karras was profoundly worried about him. His age, the lack of sleep, the demon's verbal assaults. After Marin closed his eyes and let his chin rest on his chest, Karras glanced around at Reagan, and then wearily stood up and trudged over to the bed, where he checked her pulse, and then began to take a blood pressure reading. As he wrapped the black sphygmomanometer cloth around her arm, he blinked repeatedly to clear away a blurring of his vision.
"Today Mother Day, Demi."
For a moment, the priest could not move, as he felt his heart being wrenched from his chest. And then slowly, very slowly, he looked into eyes that didn't seem to be Reagan's anymore. but rather eyes that were sadly rebuking. His mother's,
I not good to you, Demi? Why you leave me to die all alone? Why, Demi?
Damien! Marin's hand was clutching tightly at Karis's arm. Please go and rest for a little now, Damien.
Demi, please.
Do not listen, Damien. Go. Go now. With a lump rising dry to his throat, Karis turned and left the bedroom, and for a time he stood in the hallway, weak and irresolute. Coffee? He craved it, but a shower even more. But when he left the McNeil house and returned to his room in the residence hall, it took only one look at his bed for Karis to change his priorities. Forget the shower, man. Sleep half an hour. As he reached for a telephone to ask reception to give him a wake-up call, it rang. Yes, hello. Someone here to see you, Father Karis. Mr. Kinderman? Karis briefly held his breath, and then he exhaled in resignation. Okay, tell him I'll be out in just a minute, he said weakly. As he hung up the telephone, Karis saw a carton of non-filtered Camel cigarettes on his desk. A note from Dyer was attached. A key to the Playboy Club has been found on the chapel kneeler in front of the votive lights. Is it yours? You can claim it at reception. Joe. With a fond expression, Karis set down the note, quickly dressed in fresh clothing, and walked out of the room into reception, where Kinderman was standing at the telephone switchboard counter, delicately rearranging the composition of a vase full of flowers. As he turned and saw Karis, he was holding the stem of a pink camellia.
Ah, Father, Father Karis,
Kinderman greeted him cheerfully, his expression quickly changing to concern when he saw the exhaustion in the Jesuit's face. He replaced the camellia and came forward to meet him.
My God, you look awful, he said. What's the matter? That's what comes of all this schlepping around the track. Give it up, Father. You're going to die anyway.
Listen, come. He gripped Karis by the elbow and an upper arm and propelled him toward the exit to the street.
You got a minute, he asked as they passed through the door.
Well, just barely, Karis murmured. What is it?
A little talk. I need advice.
No, just that. I need advice, nothing more. Advice about what?
In just a minute. For now, we'll just walk. We'll take air. We'll enjoy.
He hooked his arm through the Jesuit's and guided him diagonally to the other side of the street.
Ah, now look at that. Beautiful. Gorgeous.
Kinderman was pointing to the sun sinking low on the Potomac. And then the stillness, sudden laughter rang out, and then the talking altogether of Georgetown undergraduates in front of a drinking hall near the corner of 36th Street. One punched another one hard on the arm, and the two began amicably wrestling.
Ah, college, breathed out Kinderman ruefully as he glanced at the lively gathering of young men. I never went, but I wish.
Turning his gaze back to Karis, he frowned with concern.
I mean, seriously, you really look bad, he said.
What's the matter? You been sick? When would Kinderman come to the point, Karis wondered.
No, I've just been busy, the Jesuit answered.
Slow it down, then, wheezed Kinderman.
Slow.
Ah, you saw the Bolshoi Ballet, incidentally, at the Watergate?
No?
No, me neither. But I wish they're so graceful, Dad. They're so cute. They had come to the car barn's low stone wall, where the view of the sunset was unimpeded, and they stopped. Karis, resting a forearm on top of the wall, and turning his glance from the sunset to Kinderman.
Okay, what's on your mind? Karis asked him.
Well, Father, said Kinderman, sighing. He turned then, hunching forward with his hands clasped on top of the wall as he moodily stared across the river and said,
I'm afraid I've got a problem.
Professional?
Well, partly, only partly.
What is it?
Well, mostly it's,
Kinderman hesitated, then continued.
Well, mostly it's ethical, you could say, Father Karras. A question, His voice trailing off, the detective turned around, and leaning his back against the wall, he looked down at the sidewalk and frowned. There's just no one I could talk to about it. Not my captain in particular, you see. I just couldn't. I couldn't tell him. So I thought... Here abruptly, the detective's eyes lit up. Listen, I had an aunt. You should hear this. This is funny. She was terrified. Terrified for years of my uncle. The poor woman, she never dared say a word to him. Never. Much less to ever raise her voice. So whenever she got mad at him for something, right away she'd run quick to the closet in her bedroom, and then there in the dark, you won't believe this, in the dark by herself, with all the clothes hanging up and the moths, she would curse. She'd curse at my uncle and tell him what she thought of him for maybe 20 minutes. Really? I mean, yelling. She'd come out, she'd feel better, she'd go kiss him on the cheek. Now what is that, Father Karras? That's good therapy or not? It's very good, Karras answered with a wan, bleak smile. And I'm your closet now? Is that what you're saying? In a way, the detective answered gravely. But more serious, Father. And the closet must speak. Got a cigarette on you? Kinderman stared at Karras blankly, incredulous. A condition like mine, and I would smoke? No, you wouldn't, Karras murmured as he turned to face the river and clasped his hands atop the wall. It was to make them stop trembling. Some doctor. God forbid I should be sick of some jungle, and instead of Albert Schweitzer, there is with me only you. You cure warts still with frogs, Dr. Karras? It's toads, Karras answered, subdued. Kinderman frowned. You're not smiling jaunty jolly today, Father Karras. Something's wrong. What is it? Come on, tell me. Karras lowered his head and was silent. Then okay, he said softly. Ask the closet whatever you want. Sighing, the detective faced out to the river. I was saying, he began. He scratched his brow with a thumbnail, then continued. I was saying, well, let's say I'm working on a case, Father Karras. It's a homicide. Dennings? No, you wouldn't be familiar with it, Father. It's something purely hypothetical. Got it. Like a ritual witchcraft murders, look, the detective continued broodingly, picking his words very carefully and slowly. And let us say that in this house, this hypothetical house, there are living five people, and that one must be the killer. With his hand, he made flat, chopping motions of emphasis. Now I know this. I know this. I know this for a fact. Then he paused, slowly exhaling breath. Ah, but then the problem. All the evidence. It points to a child, Father Karras. A little girl, maybe, I don't know, 10, 12 years old. Just a baby. She could maybe be my daughter. Yes, I know. Sounds fantastic. Ridiculous. But true. Now there comes to this house, Father Karras, a very famous Catholic priest. And this case being purely hypothetical, Father, I learned through my also hypothetical genius that this priest has once cured a very special type illness. An illness which is mental, by the way, a fact I mentioned just in passing for your interest. Karras mournfully lowered his head and nodded. Yeah, go on. What else? What else? A great deal. It also seems there is, well, Satanism involved in this illness, plus also strength. Yes, incredible strength. And this hypothetical girl, let us say, then, could so easily twist a man's head around. Head lowered, the detective was nodding now. Yes, she could. And so the question, breaking off, the detective grimaced thoughtfully, then went on. You see, You see, the girl is not responsible, Father. She's insane, Father. Totally demented, and also just a child, Father Karras. A child. And yet the illness that she has, it could be dangerous. She could kill someone else. Who's to know? Once again, the detective turned and squinted out across the river. It's a problem, he said quietly and morosely. What to do? Hypothetically, I mean. Just forget it, and hope she gets... Kinderman paused. Gets well? He reached for a handkerchief and blew his nose. I don't know. I just don't know. It's a terrible decision, he said, as he searched for a clean, unused section of the handkerchief. Yeah? It's awful. Just, God, awful, horrific. And I hate to be the one who has to make it. He again blew his nose, lightly dabbed at a nostril, then stuffed the damp handkerchief back into a pocket. Father, what would be right in such a case? He asked, turning back to Karras. Hypothetically, I mean. What do you believe would be the right thing to do? For an instant, Karras throbbed with a surge of rebellion, with a dull, weary anger at the piling on of weight upon weight. He let it ebb away into calm, and firmly meeting the detective's gaze, he answered softly, I would put it in the hands of a higher authority. I believe it is there at this moment, answered Kinderman. Yes, and I'd leave it there, Lieutenant. For some moments, their gazes stayed locked. Then Kinderman nodded, saying, Yes, Father, yes, yes, I thought you would say that. He turned to again observe the sunset. So beautiful, he said. And so what makes us think such a thing has beauty while the Leaning Tower of Pisa does not? Also lizards and armadillos? Another mystery. He tucked back his sleeve for a look at his wristwatch. Ah, well, I have to go. Any minute Mrs. K will be shrying that the dinner is cold. He turned back to Karras. Thank you, Father. I feel better. Much better. Oh, incidentally, you could maybe do a favor? Give a message? If by chance you should ever meet a man, last name Engstrom, please tell him... Well, just say to him, Elvira is in a clinic. She's all right. He'll understand. Would you do that? I mean, if, by some crazy chance, you should meet him. Faintly puzzled, Karras answered, Yeah, I will. Look, we couldn't make a film some night, Father. Karras cast his eyes down and nodding murmured, Yeah, soon. You're like a rabbi when he mentions the Messiah. Always soon. Listen, do me yet another favor, please, would you, Father? Glancing up, Karras saw that the detective looked gravely concerned. Stop this running round the track for a little. Just walk. Okay, Father? Slow it down. Could you do that? Do it for me, please? Karras smiled faintly and said, I will. Hands in the pockets of his coat, the detective looked down at the sidewalk in resignation. Yes, I know, he said, nodding. Soon. Always soon. As he started away, he stopped, reached up a hand to the Jesuit's shoulder and squeezed, saying, Ilya Kazan, your director, sends regards, Marlin. For a time, Karras watched him as he listed down the street. Watched with fondness and with wonder at the heart's labyrinthine turnings and improbable redemptions. He looked up at the clouds washed in pink above the river, then beyond to the west, where they drifted at the edge of the world, glowing faintly like a promise remembered. There'd been a time when he often saw God in such sights, felt his breath in the tinting of clouds, as now the lines of a poem he'd once loved returned to haunt him. Glory be to God for dappled things, for skies of couple color as a brindled cow, Furrows moles all in stipple upon trout that swim. Fresh fire cold chestnut falls, finches wings. He fathers forth whose beauty is past change. Praise him. Karras pressed the side of a fist against his lips and looked down against the sadness and the pain of loss swelling up from his throat toward the corners of his eyes as he thought of a line from a psalm that once filled him with joy. O Lord, he remembered achingly, I have loved the beauty of thy house. Karras waited, did not dare risk another glance at the sunset. Instead, he looked up at Reagan's window. Sharon let him in and told him nothing had changed. She was carrying a bundle of foul-smelling laundry. She excused herself. I've got to get this into the washing machine. Karras watched her, thought of coffee, but now he heard the demon croaking viciously at Marin. He started toward the staircase, but then stopped as he remembered the message he was supposed to give Carl. Where was he? He turned to ask Sharon and glimpsed her disappearing down the basement steps. He went looking for the houseman in the kitchen. He wasn't there, only Chris. Her elbows propped and hands cupped at her temples. She was sitting at the breakfast table looking down at... what was it? Karras quietly moved closer. Stopped. A photo album. Scraps of paper, pasted photos. Chris hadn't seen him. Excuse me, please, Karras said softly. Is Carl in his room? Chris looked up at him wanly and shook her head. He's on an errand, Father. Karras heard a sniffle. And there's coffee there, Father. Ought to perk in just a minute. As Karras glanced over at the percolator light, he heard Chris getting up from the table, and when he turned, he saw her moving quickly past him with her face averted. He heard a quavery, excuse me? And in a moment, Chris had exited the kitchen. Karras looked down at the photo album. Candid shots, a young girl, very pretty. With a pang, Karras realized he was looking at Reagan. Here, blowing out candles on a whipped creamy birthday cake. Here, sitting on a lakefront dock in shorts and a t-shirt, waving gaily at the camera. Something was stenciled on the front of the t-shirt. Camp something or other. He couldn't make it out. On the opposite page, a ruled sheet of paper bore the script of a child. If instead of just clay, I could take all the prettiest things, like a rainbow, or clouds, or the way a bird sings, maybe then, dearest mommy, if I put them all together, I could really make a sculpture of you. Below the poem, I love you. Happy Mother's Day. The signature in pencil was Rags. Karras shut his eyes. He could not bear this chance meeting. He turned away wearily and waited for the coffee to brew. With lowered head, he gripped the counter and again closed his eyes. Shut it out, he thought. Shut it all out. But he couldn't. And as he listened to the thumping and bubbling of the percolating coffee, his hands began trembling again as compassion swelled suddenly and blindly into rage at disease and at pain, at the suffering of children and the frailty of the body and the monstrous and outrageous corruption of death. If instead of just clay, the rage ebbed away to sorrow and helpless frustration. All the prettiest things. He could not wait for coffee. He must go. He must do something, help someone, try. He left the kitchen, and as he came to the living room, he looked through the open door and saw Chris on the sofa, sobbing convulsively, while Sharon tried comforting her. He looked away and walked up the stairs, heard the demon roaring frenziedly at Marin.
You would have lost! You would have lost, and you knew it, you scum, Marin bastard! Come back!
Karras blocked it out. Or the way a bird sings. As he entered Reagan's bedroom, Karras realized he had forgotten to put on his sweater. Slightly shivering from the cold, he turned his gaze to Reagan. Her head was sideways and a little turned away from him as the demonic voice continued to rage. He went slowly to his chair and picked up a blanket, and only then, in his exhaustion, did he notice Marin's absence. Moments later, remembering that he needed to check Reagan's blood pressure, Karras wearily got up again and was shambling toward her when abruptly he pulled up in shock. Limp and disjointed, Marin lay sprawled face down on the floor beside the bed. Karras knelt, turned him over, and seeing the bluish coloration of his face, he felt quickly for a pulse, and in a wrenching, stabbing instant of anguish, Karras realized that Marin was dead.
Saintly flatulence! Die, will you? Die! Karras, heal him! Heal him! Bring him back and let us finish!
Heart failure. Coronary artery. Oh, God. Karras groaned in a whisper. God, no. He shut his eyes and shook his head in disbelief, in despair. And then abruptly, with a surge of grief, he dug his thumb with savage force into Marin's pale wrist, as if to squeeze from its sinews the lost beat of life.
Bring him back!
Karras sagged back and took a breath. Then he saw the tiny pills scattered loose on the floor. He picked one up and with aching recognition saw that Marin had known. Nitroglycerin. He'd known. His eyes red and brimming. Karras looked at Marin's face, remembering. Go and rest for a little now, Damien.
Even worms will not eat your corruption, Marin.
Hearing the words of the demon, Karras looked up and began visibly trembling with an uncontrollable, murderous fury. Do not listen.
Homosexual!
Do not listen. Do not listen. A vein stood out angrily, throbbing on Karras's forehead, and as he picked up Marin's hands and started tenderly to place them in the form of a cross on his chest, he heard the demon croak,
Now put his cock in his hands!
As a glob of putrid spittle hit the dead priest's eye.
The last rites!
Karras stared numbly at the spittle. Did not move, could not hear above the roaring of his blood, and then slowly, in quivering, side-angling jerks, he looked up with a face that was a purpling snarl, an electrifying spasm of hatred and rage.
You son of a bitch,
Karras seethed in a burning whisper, and though he did not move, he seemed to be uncoiling, sinews of his neck pulling taut like cables. The demon stopped laughing and eyed him with malevolence. You were losing, Karras taunted. You're a loser. You've always been a loser. Reagan splattered him with vomit. He ignored it. Yeah, you're very good with children, he said through gritted teeth. Little girls. Well, come on, let's see you try something bigger, huh? Come on! He had his hands out like great fleshy hooks, slowly beckoning, inviting. Come on, loser, try me. Leave the girl and take me, come into me. The next instant, Karras's upper body jerked sharply upright, with his head bent back and facing up at the ceiling, and then convulsively down and forward again, with the Jesuit's features twitching and contorting into a mask of unthinkable hatred and rage, while in strong spasmodic jerks, as if pushing against some unseen resistance, the Jesuit's large and powerful hands were reaching out to clutch the throat of a screaming Reagan McNeil. Chris and Sharon heard the sounds. They were in the study. Chris sat at the bar while Sharon was behind it, mixing them a drink, when both the women glanced up at the ceiling as they heard a commotion in Reagan's bedroom. Reagan screaming in terror, and then Karras's voice fiercely shouting, "No!" And then stumblings, sharp bumps against furniture, against the wall. Chris knocked her drink over as she flinched at a violent crashing sound, a sound of breaking glass, and in an instant she and Sharon were racing up the stairs to the door of Reagan's bedroom, where, bursting in, they saw the shutters of the window on the floor ripped off their hinges, and the window, the glass had been totally shattered. Alarmed, they rushed forward toward the window, and as they did, Chris saw Merrin on the floor by the bed. She gasped, standing rooted in shock. And then she ran to him, kneeling beside him. "Oh, my God! Sharon! Cher, come here! Come here!" Sharon's scream of horror cut her off. Chris looked up bloodlessly, gaping, and saw Sharon at the window staring down at the steps with both hands to her cheeks. "Cher, what is it?"
"It's Karras! Father Karras!" Sharon cried out,
hysterically racing from the room. Her face ashen, Chris got up and moved quietly to the window, looked below, and felt her heart dropping out of her body. At the bottom of the steps on M Street, Karras lay crumpled and bloody as a crowd began gathering around him. A hand to her cheek as she stared down in horror, Chris tried to move her lips, to speak. She couldn't.
"Mother?"
A small, wan voice calling tearfully behind her. Chris partly turned her head, her eyes wide, not quite daring to believe what she had heard. Then the voice came again.
"Reagan's. Mother? Mother, what's happening? Come here. I'm afraid, Mom. Oh, please, Mom. Please, please come here."
Chris had turned and seen the tears of confusion, and suddenly she was racing to the bed, weeping,
"Rags! Oh, my baby, oh, Rags! It's really you! It's really you!"
Downstairs, Sharon lunged from the house and ran frantically to the Jesuit residence hall, where she urgently asked to see Dyer. He came quickly to reception. She told him. He stared at her in shock. "Have you called an ambulance?" he asked her. "Oh, my God, no, no, I didn't think. Swiftly, Dyer gave instructions to the switchboard operator, then raced from the hall along with Sharon, crossed the street, raced down the steps. "Let me through, please, coming through." As he pushed his way through the bystanders, Dyer heard murmurs of the litany of indifference. "Hey, what happened?" "Ah, some guy fell down the steps." "Yeah? Must have been drunk. See? Look at the vomit." "Come on, sweeties. We're going to be late." At last, Dyer broke through, and for a heart-stopping instant, he felt frozen in a timeless dimension of grief, in a space where the air was too painful to breathe. Karras lay crumpled and twisted on his back, with his head in the center of a growing pool of blood, his jaw slack, an odd shine in his eyes. He'd been fixedly staring upward, as if at the patiently waiting stars of some beckoning, mysterious horizon. But now his eyes shifted over to Dyer, seemed to glow with an elation, of completion, of something like triumph. And then with some plea, something urgent. "Come on, move back now, move it back, folks." A policeman. Dyer knelt and put a light, tender hand, like a caress, against the bruised, gashed face. So many cuts. A bloody ribbon trickled down from the mouth. "Damien?" Dyer paused to still the quaver in his throat. As in Karras's eyes he saw that faint, eager shine, the warm plea. Leaning over, Dyer asked, "Can you talk?" Slowly, Karras reached his hand to Dyer's wrist. He clutched it and gave it a squeeze. Fighting back the tears, Dyer leaned down closer, and putting his mouth next to Karras's ear, he asked softly, "Do you want to make your confession now, Damien?" A squeeze. "Are you sorry for all the sins of your life and for having offended Almighty God?" the hand slowly releasing, and then a squeeze. Leaning back upright, Dyer slowly traced the sign of the cross over Karras as he emotionally recited the words of absolution. Ego te absolvo. An enormous tear rolled down from a corner of Karras's eye, and now Dyer felt his wrist being squeezed even harder, continuously, as he finished the absolution. In nomine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti. Amen. Dyer leaned over again, with his mouth next to Karras's ear, waited, forced the swelling from his throat, and then he murmured, Damien, are you? Dyer stopped short. The pressure on his wrist had abruptly slackened. He pulled back his head and saw the eyes filled with peace and with something else, something like joy at the end of heart's longing. The eyes were still staring, but at nothing in this world, nothing here. Slowly and tenderly, Dyer slid the eyelids down. He heard the ambulance wail from afar, and he began to say goodbye, but could not finish. He lowered his head and wept. The ambulance arrived. They put Karras on a stretcher, and as they were loading him aboard, Dyer climbed in and sat beside the intern. He reached over and took Karras's hand. Hey, there's nothing you can do for him now, Father, said the intern in a kindly voice. Don't make it harder on yourself, Father. Don't come. His gaze holding on that chipped, torn face, Dyer slowly shook his head and said quietly, No, I'm coming. The intern looked up to the ambulance rear door, where the patiently waiting driver was standing and looking in with his eyebrows raised in a question. The intern mutely nodded, and the rear door was raised and locked shut. From the sidewalk, Sharon watched numbly as the ambulance slowly drove away. She heard murmurs from the bystanders. Hey, what happened here?
Oh, well, who the hell knows?
The wail of the ambulance siren lifted shrill into night above the river. Then abruptly it ceased. The driver had remembered that time no longer mattered.